because we're still above freezing, and Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva is right at the freezing point, so they're getting more snow. Here are the numbers. 35 for Racine, 34 Kenosha, 32 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm incredibly excited about the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show because we're going to be talking about a truly extraordinary new book, which talks about a pivotal moment in world history and the important role played by a man whose name most of us do not know. In fact, it's a name that most of us have never heard. But once upon a time, many Americans knew the name of Joseph Clark Grew, one of the most important diplomats in U.S. history. Called at one point in this book, Our Man in Tokyo, a legend in the State Department. He was serving as our ambassador to Japan in the 1930s, leading right up to the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. But Joseph Clark Grew, in those years stationed in Japan, worked tirelessly to stave off what seemed in many respects like impending inevitable war with Japan. And much of this story has never been told until now. Steve Kemper has done an amazing job of telling the story of Joseph Clark Grew and his tireless, even heroic efforts to preserve the peace in his book called Our Man in Tokyo, an American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor, published by Mariner Books. Previous books by Steve Kemper include A Splendid Savage, The Restless Life of Frederick Russell Burnham, Codename Ginger, The Story Behind Segway and Dean Kamen's Quest to Invent a New World. He's written extensively for Smithsonian, National Geographic, many other publications, and has taught writing and journalism. Again, this new book is titled Our Man in Tokyo. Steve Kemper, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I am so excited about this. This book strikes me as one of those books that should have been written a long, long time ago. And although there is an impressive and helpful biography of Joseph Clark Grew, which you tell us was written, I think, over a half century ago, I'm not aware of the existence of a book that has examined this specific story, at least in such thorough fashion. What do you make of this important story being, at least to some extent, largely untold until now?
Boy, that's a you start off with a big question. first, I should correct. There is another book that came out a few years ago about Joseph Grew, and it was being written as I was researching my book. I found out about it later. So I'm not the first one to come back to Grew, but I hope my book is more interesting. He is. I don't know why he's been ignored. I mean, I think people get swallowed up in the drama of Pearl Harbor and the aftermath of the Pacific War. I think he's just part of a bigger issue, which is that most Americans know very little about Japan in the 1930s. Compared to what we know about Germany in the 1930s, the rise of Hitler, the rise of Nazism, Kristallnacht, the brown shirts, the trains. We all know that history. It's in our cultural memory. But Japan, for some reason, in American historical memory, starts with Pearl Harbor. And so I think Grew has got drowned in that oblivion.
And I should say that although your book is really primarily about Mr. Gru and his efforts to somehow stave off impending war, that you also do a marvelous job of painting a detailed sort of backdrop for us of events in Japan and the turbulence that engulfed that country. And I think you're absolutely right. Most of us Americans know very, very little about that, and it's important for us to know that in order for us to properly understand the context in which Pearl Harbor took place. I mentioned in my introduction that somebody called Joseph Clark Gru a legend in the State Department, but you also say in your book, most ambassadors remain nameless to the general public. But he actually, in fact, became quite well known, at least compared to most of his colleagues in foreign service. Just describe to us the extent to which this was true, that he was, in fact, a well-known figure, a well-known name, more so than the typical diplomat might be.
Well, I'd base this on several things. There's a massive file of clippings in the Gru papers. For every year that he was there, he had a clipping service, and he got all the clippings about him sent to him, and there are a lot of them. He was constantly being quoted and photographed for the U.S. papers because Japan was constantly aggravating the United States, and so there was coverage in the papers. And it's also interesting, I didn't put it in my book, I ended up cutting it out, but he would get recognized on the street. I put that in the book. I didn't put in that when at one point he was going across country to go back to Japan, and he wanted to visit some friends in Los Angeles, and we tried to do it anonymously, but he got seen, and he got reported in the gossip columns in the Los Angeles papers. That's how not many ambassadors are considered fodder for that. So that's how well-known he was.
One of the things you tell us is that Joseph Clark Gru, although he was ultimately an incredibly accomplished diplomat, was, I think at one point you say, not necessarily a natural for the post. That is, he grew up in a family and had a father who had very, very different aspirations for him. Tell us what his destiny might have been, sort of the unlived life that he ultimately avoided in favor of the calling that he embraced.
Yes, he was the child of Boston Brahmins. He was raised on Beacon Hill, an old Boston family. And old Boston families have traditions, and one of them is that you go to Harvard, and then you settle down in Boston, and you go to work in banking or business. And Gru, his skin crawled at the thought of that. So his father was very disappointed that he had decided to do something else, and so he sent young Joseph, after graduation from Harvard, off on a year's sojourn around the world. Gru didn't choose to go to Paris or London or Venice. He went to the Far East, and he roughed it, hunting, you know, hacking his way through jungles, catching malaria. He was an adventurous kind of guy, and that's what ended up appealing to him about the Foreign Service. The idea of serving his country in a foreign place sounded adventurous to him. And he chose State Department over State Street.
Tell us about his career as a diplomat ahead of his appointment by President Hoover to become our ambassador to Japan. Just sketch for us kind of the length and breadth and scope of his career in Foreign Service.
Well, he served in 14 posts, and they were all over the world, Berlin, Mexico, Vienna. He became the ambassador to Denmark. He was the ambassador to Switzerland. He served at one point as Assistant Secretary of State, which is second in charge to the State Department. And then he was appointed ambassador to Turkey, which was a very tricky post at that time. And that's where he was when Japan invaded Manchuria. Its army did, without seeking permission from the civilian government of Japan, and that's when President Hoover and Secretary of State Stimson decided we need our best man to go to Tokyo and figure out what's going on and try to talk some sense into the Japanese people, the Japanese government. So that's how he ended up in Tokyo in 1932.
We're speaking with Steve Kemper and talking about his latest book, which is Our Man in Tokyo, an American ambassador and the countdown to Pearl Harbor. The book focuses on the nearly 10 years that Joseph Clark Grew served as U.S. ambassador to the nation of Japan, beginning in 1932 and extending for a few months past Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor. Before we dig into some of the fascinating details of this central story of your book, I wonder if we could just talk for a moment about something that I suspect you have come to a much more profound understanding and appreciation of through the course of writing this book, and certainly an understanding that probably dwarfs that of the normal American. And I'm talking about the work of foreign diplomats, the work of those who undertake foreign service of this kind. And I'm sure you came to this project with at least some knowledge of that, of the challenges, even apart from specifically what Mr. Grew faced in Japan at this especially difficult moment in that country's history. But I wonder if we could just talk for a few moments in general about the work of diplomats and maybe some of what you came to understand better as you more deeply explored the story of Joseph Clark Grew and his work.
That's a very good question. Diplomacy is a craft and an art, and Grew took it very seriously. He thought about it a lot. It's the basis of diplomacy, of course, are rationality, logic, compromise, personal relationships, and enlightened self-interest on each side. And Grew believed that if each side was guided by those things, in particular enlightened self-interest, you could come to a compromise that would please both people, both sides. Diplomacy is the reason that we don't know many ambassadors' names is that if it's done right, the name isn't in the news. The good ambassador's job is to keep out of the news. He's supposed to soothe things and solve things before they reach the headlines. That's the ideal for a diplomat. It was certainly what Grew attempted. He often, almost always, spoke behind the scenes, and that's exactly where ambassadors work, behind the scenes, to the leaders of Japan, because he didn't want to negotiate in the media, in the newspapers, because that's the way that you lose. So he was constantly talking to these people in private and trying to work things out that way. So it takes patience. It takes respect for the other side's view. It takes empathy for their perspective. It takes a willingness to see that perspective, because if you don't understand it and see it, how are you going to be able to propose things that might meet those expectations? So Grew practiced all this with great skill, I think. And what I learned in this research is that no matter how great a diplomat you are and how many skills you have in that area, they are vaporized by irrationality, fanaticism, lies, refusal to accept reality and the truth.
That's, of course, one of the central points of your book, is that even a man as gifted and devoted to country as Joseph Clark Grew, there is a limit to what one man can accomplish in the face of something like he faced in Japan in the 1930s. I want to talk about a couple other matters again that in some ways are of more general, overarching relevance to this story. At one point, I think you quote Joseph Clark Grew himself as saying, "I am an optimist both by nature and by conviction." I wonder if you could take apart those words by Mr. Grew describing himself and the role that you think that played in his diplomatic work, that idea of being an optimist both by nature and by conviction. What is the role or the value of optimism in the diplomatic arena?
I think Gru would say it's the only possible stance that for a diplomat to take, because if you are pessimistic, how are you ever going to accomplish your goals? If you go in feeling defeated or as if you're likely to fail, you will. And so he was an optimist by personality. He was very gregarious, very friendly, amiable, charming. The Japanese people, the Japanese leaders were really liked him, unlike a lot of other diplomats in Tokyo at the time. And he was an optimist by conviction because of what I just mentioned. He had to be that way in order to be a diplomat and try to accomplish anything. After the war, there was the commission, the Congressional Commission on Pearl Harbor, investigating why did this happen? How did this happen? Why weren't we aware of it? It was a deeply partisan commission, and the Republicans were looking for scapegoats. And they asked Gru, when did you know that war was inevitable? And they were hoping he would say, oh, you know, back in the summer of 1940 or early 41. And Gru said, never. And that's the only way an ambassador should ever think about his post when he's in it.
There's one other quote by Mr. Gru that I want you to talk about. This is one of my favorite moments in the whole book. It is, I think, in the chapter called Settling in which he is talking about, or you explore, the myriad challenges that he faced right off the bat. And some of those challenges would probably be similar to the challenges whenever a diplomat was settling into a brand new post. He said at one point in describing his work that his main job was to interpret each country to the other, to interpret each country to the other. I'm not sure I've ever heard the work of diplomats described exactly that way, with that turn of phrase, but it makes so much sense. Tell us more about that description of his work and how apt you think it is for the story of Joseph Clark Gru.
Oh, I think it's foundational for diplomacy, and certainly Gru expressed it in his usual succinct way. An ambassador has to work towards both his home government, because he's representing the policies of that home government, and he has to work towards the host government to try to persuade the host government that these policies are mutually beneficial. So he is an interpreter. He stands in the middle and he says, this is what my leaders are thinking about what you've done and what you're saying. And he says to his home government, here are the responses I'm getting to the policies that you're proposing over here, and they don't like this part, and you better change this, and we need to think about this. So he's trying to get both sides to meet in the middle. He's an interpreter.
We're speaking with Steve Kemper. We're talking about his book, Our Man in Tokyo, an American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor. So in 1932, President Herbert Hoover decides that he needs to, in effect, transfer Joseph Clark Gru from Turkey, a very important post, to perhaps an even more important post as our lead ambassador to Japan. You say that Hoover appointed Gru to the most difficult post in the world at the time, Japan. I mean, in other words, no diplomat could have faced a more difficult challenge than to be dispatched to Japan. Tell us why this was such a difficult assignment for Joseph Clark Gru. What was going on in Japan at the time that made it, in a sense, a diplomatic maze?
Well, first, to keep in mind, some people might think Germany would be the most difficult post, but it was 32. It was really before Hitler and the Nazis seemed like that serious a threat, whereas the Japanese, after they invaded Manchuria and started shaking their sabers, were literally a huge threat. They were the most powerful nation in the Far East, where the U.S. and Western powers had vast interests in China and in Indochina, in the Southeast Asia. So it was crucial to have someone there who could deal with this immense power, and there was really nobody that could compare to Japan in the entire Eastern Hemisphere, with not the case in the Western Hemisphere. So you needed someone there who was capable of dealing with this power, which appeared to be descending into chaos and militarism and nationalism. Not just appeared to, they were. They had assassinated two prime ministers within a couple of years. They were killing off prominent business people and cabinet members, former cabinet members. The army was seeming to be taking over the civilian government. It was a parliamentary democracy in Japan at the time, but the Diet, which was the name of the parliament, was getting less and less respect from the military, who seemed to be taking foreign policy as part of their bailiwick. Instead of taking orders from the civilian government, they were giving orders to the civilian government. So it was a mess, and it wasn't just a mess because that was happening in the military, it was because it was complete chaos within the military. They were also killing each other within the military. They were assassinating people, generals and officers that the fanatics didn't like, who weren't moving fast enough to fulfill the imperial ambitions of these nationalists. So it was a huge mess there, and that's one of the big surprises for me. You know, Germany was, at least when Hitler took over, there was a strongman form of government. Same thing in Italy. So there was some stability, even though it was a horrifying stability, in terms of the government itself. In Japan, that wasn't true. GRU dealt with 17 foreign ministers in those 10 years because the cabinets constantly were toppling because there was so much chaos and erratic behavior and jostling for power.
Well, and I think if I remember correctly, you tell us also 12 different prime ministers during that decade.
That's right.
Incredible. You write at one point, there were clusters of power, but no central control. Tiers of authority, but no one in charge. For a diplomat looking for the levers of power and influence, the Japanese political system was a maze. One of the things you tell us is that at least part of the source of all of this turbulence and really utter chaos at certain points was the Japanese constitution, the way in which the government had been set up. You really called it the root problem. Tell us when this constitution was put in place and what you see as its most glaring deficiencies that led to these unanticipated consequences.
Go back just a bit, you have to remember that Japan was a feudal society until the 1850s. It was closed to the outside world, literally closed. It didn't let anyone in until Commodore Perry went over there with his black ships and said, "You are opening up. We want to trade with you, and this will be good for you." And Japan, in the course of 50 years, became the power in the Far East and one of the most amazing transformations in history. And they did that by adopting Western principles, Western ways, Western business practices, military practices, educational systems, the whole thing. But it had only been done 100 years, not even 100 years earlier. So you still had, as we know from knowledge about history, you can't just chop off your leg and act like, you know, I'm okay. It's still going to be there. Your history you carry with you into the future. So Japan had this incredibly modern aspect, this modern face, but it also had this incredibly traditional neo-feudal background. And I got a little lost in my own answer there. The Constitution. There it is. So when they adopted a constitutional form of government, the first constitutional form of government in Asia, I think that was in the 1890s, the Constitution made the emperor the commander-in-chief, the leader of the nation, and the spiritual leader of the nation, because, after all, he was a god. They literally considered the emperor a god. And they also put the military under the emperor's rule as commander-in-chief. They thought that was a good thing to do. It would keep the military out of the civilian government. So on the other side, you had the parliament and you had the cabinet. But the emperor appoints the prime minister. The emperor appoints the prime minister, and so that means that you have this person who has, by the way, he supposedly has all power because he's in control of everything. But on the other hand, he's a god, so we can't let him make any real decisions because he's infallible. And if he's infallible, he can't make mistakes. And the only way not to make a mistake is not to make any decisions. So that was the position of Hirohito. It was impossible. And so because he became a figurehead, more or less, but divine, he was capable of being used in any way that nationalist and militarist wanted to use him. We are acting in the name of the emperor for his good, for the good of Japan, because he is Japan. And so there's this flaw in the Constitution where the military appointed the Minister of War and the Minister of the Navy. The military appointed those two cabinet members. And that meant that all they had to do was withdraw that cabinet member from the cabinet, and the cabinet would fall because nobody else could appoint that foreign minister except those branches of the service. And the military did that a number of times throughout Gru's tenure. So instead of controlling the military with the civilian government, it effectively put the military in charge of government, in charge of will the cabinet live or will the cabinet collapse? And constantly it collapsed because the military pulled its strings.
You, at one point in describing this to us in your book, you write, in effect, the prime minister served at the pleasure of the military. And that's a really scary scenario. And, of course, it's kind of hard for us to wrap our heads around the notion that somebody as seemingly important as the prime minister of Japan, in a sense, had relatively no power whatsoever compared to the power and authority of the military.
Well, as long as the prime minister acted in accordance with the military's wishes, then the prime minister was safe. And there were also, it wasn't simple. It wasn't just that simple. There were other ministers who could resist the military. It wasn't it was always more complicated than simply the military gets to decide everything. Although they had the most power and they did make the most important decisions, they were held in check for a while by the appointment of the prime minister, who then appointed the foreign minister, for instance, who would have a huge impact on dealings with other countries. And so, and the emperor and his advisors controlled that. There was a group of palace advisors, foreign ex officials, usually prime ministers, in fact, called the Genro, G-E-N-R-O. And by the time Gru got there, the Genro had come down to just one person. They had all died off. There was one man left, Prince Seongji. And the emperor would never consider appointing a prime minister unless he had gotten the advice of Prince Seongji. Prince Seongji was a moderate who was, he wanted good relations with the U.S. and with Europe. And so he would not allow the appointment of a prime minister who was opposed to that relationship. So there was a time in the early to mid, even almost into the late 30s, where the prime minister could sort of still direct Japan away from complete militarism and expansionism, but not totally, because the army was a wild card and kept acting without the civilian government's approval.
You tell us that right around the time that that Joseph Gru became ambassador to Japan, this is early 1932, that just ahead of that, I think, Japan's prime minister is assassinated, the second prime minister to be assassinated in 18 months. And it seems that at the heart of this kind of activity, and it wasn't even just limited to those two assassinations, was plotters trying to sow chaos and terror that, in your words, would embolden the army to impose martial law. Tell us more about those efforts and to what extent they ultimately were successful.
Well, they were constant, and that's another aspect of this which is so interesting and complicated. There were constantly throughout the 1930s these plots to assassinate political leaders and bring about chaos, which would allow the declaration of martial law, then the military could take over totally. But there were police from the Home Ministry, and there were the army's military police, the Kempeitai, they're called, who would sniff out these conspiracies and arrest the people involved. So even within the army and the central government, you had police forces who were corrupted by militarism, but not so corrupted that they wouldn't still arrest seditionists. That began to change as the decade wore on. They became closer and closer to the seditionist point of view. So you had it's very fascinating that the army was in conflict with itself, and the army was often in conflict with the Navy. The Navy was always saying the army's nuts. They want to take Japan down the tubes. If we do what the army wants, we're going to have everybody in the world attacking us. And then eventually the Navy went over to the Army's point of view, too. And that was sort of the beginning of the end for any hope for peace. There was a coup in 1936. There were a bunch of military officers who actually took over military headquarters. They took over some government buildings. They took over the Diet building. And they demanded, they killed a bunch of people, and they demanded that their own choices for prime minister and foreign minister be put in. And the emperor said, go get them, and if they don't surrender, I want them dead. So they failed, but they tried. And this was happening all the time in this really chaotic, feverish country.
Right. In fact, you tell us in that incident that occurred in February of 1936 that there may have been upwards of 1,500 soldiers who were involved in that coup attempt. And it's so interesting to think about to whatever extent Americans had awareness of Japan at that time. And I think even as we look back with the hindsight of looking backward at history, that we think of Japan in this period as this incredible, frighteningly formidable military force, which of course they were, but tied up in the picture is this chaos, which one would think would have had some effect of undermining their effectiveness, and maybe they would have been an even more formidable force if this chaos had not been there. Or did that chaos serve some kind of, in a sense, positive function for the Japanese military?
Oh, I think that it served a positive function for the people who wanted to take Japan in the direction of imperial aggression. So, because of that, that sort of group thrives on chaos, thrives on lies, thrives on conspiracies. If you can promote resentment and fear, and we need to get this under control, or it's going to get very, very bad. That's exactly what totalitarianism attempts to do. Please take care of us. Please take over because we're frightened. Do what you need to do, and that's perfect for people who want to, topple civilian government and put something totalitarian in its place. But let me add one thing there, because
yes,
what you brought up is interesting. GRU saw this chaos as diplomatic opportunity often. It showed him the country was not completely settled into one path, that there were cracks in this that he could possibly lever. But in Washington, they tended to see Japan as a monolith, as they are the militarists who are trying to take over the Far East. And that's what we see. And don't tell us it's any different. And if you tell us it's different, it's because you've gone native and you're willing to appease these aggressors, which frustrated Gru tremendously.
We're speaking with Steve Kemper, author of Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor. One of the things you're careful to do in your book is to spell out the genuine grievances, the understandable grievances which Japan had against the West. And I think one could very easily write a book like this and, in a sense, not take the time to do that. I really appreciate the fact that that element is part of the way that you tell this story. Briefly spell out the nature of the grievances Japan had against the West, because of that, of course, is sort of fuel for the fire that ultimately engulfs the world.
Well, there were quite a few. We can start with World War I. Japan came in as an ally to the Western powers in World War I and helped to win the war in the Far East for the good guys. And after the war, they wanted their spoils, the way the Western powers had always taken their spoils. They wanted pieces of Russia and China and Korea and so on. And the Western powers said, nope, you can't have any. So they were resentful of that. Then there was the League of Nations, which Japan went to Versailles as one of the world powers to help set up the League of Nations and the charter. Japan wanted included in the charter immigration policies that would allow immigration freely among the signatories of this charter. And Wilson said no. He gave in to the southern bigots and said, no, we're not going to have that in there. So Japan resented that tremendously. Then on top of that, the U.S. Congress passed what colloquially was called the Exclusion Act, which meant that it excluded anyone Asian from immigrating, anyone at all coming to the United States at all. So that was a slap in the face of Japan, our supposed ally. And it goes on from there. Then on the other side of it, there's the financial side. Japan is a small country. It's very poor in natural resources. That means it has to make things and sell them, export them, in order to get the currency to buy the resources it needs to continue to develop and to have a better and better life for its people. And, of course, we all know the Depression hit, 1929, 1930, many countries did was slap tariffs on Japanese goods because they wanted to protect their own industries. That meant that Japan didn't have markets for its goods, and that meant it didn't have cash. So that was tremendously, they resented that tremendously. There was China, which was at the time, we had the open door policy, it was called, which was basically an agreement by several Western powers and Japan and China to respect China's autonomy, supposedly, but also to provide equal commercial opportunity to all powers within China. And China was in chaos then, even more so than Japan. The warlords were in control. There was Chiang Kai-shek and his army. There were the communists who had started up around that time. And Japan, who had a lot of investments in China, said, please help us get control of this. And the Western powers turned their back on Japan, which is one of the reasons Japan invaded Manchuria. So you had all of these issues that Japan felt the West was trying to keep Japan from expanding, keep Japan from thriving, keep Japan from winning, from getting its just rewards. In other words, Japan was going to turn into a second-rate power. And then, of course, lastly, there's oil. Japan needed oil to run everything. It was an industrial power at this point and a military power. Both those things run on oil at the time. It had to import every drop of oil that it needed. And so it was terrified of that possibility, that the oil could be cut off and then Japan would be done as a power. So you have survival fears, and you have resentments, and it's a very strong mix to create resentment of foreign people and foreign powers and how they're treating the Japanese nation.
Hmm. Of course, there was a powerful connection between our two nations, in part because, you tell us, the United States was Japan's primary trade partner. And so it was a relationship that mattered to both nations. So what would you say was the heart and soul of Joseph Clark Grew's efforts to forge a positive relationship between the two countries, and in particular, to try to urge Japan along a path towards, in a sense, more peaceful and civilized behavior in terms of its presence on the world stage?
Well, it was a pretty simple message, really. He said to Japan, look at what being an ally of the United States and Great Britain in particular has done for Japan in the last 50, 75 years. Look at what it has brought Japan. And if you want that to continue, you can't start biting off territories, invading countries, claiming resources. And if you want to be a warlike power, you're going to lose friends and you're going to lose what you have. So why do that? It's against your best interest to make enemies out of us, who are your closest friends financially, culturally, politically. Why are you doing this? It makes no sense, and it didn't. Unless you're a militarist who wants to expand the imperial empire and, you know, have a glorious future that controls all of Asia.
When you are talking about how Joseph Clark Grew looked back on his decade as ambassador and the frustrations that he experienced in trying to maintain the peace, you tell us that his frustrations were certainly not limited to kind of the complicated labyrinth of the Japanese government and the different elements there that were so difficult to deal with, but that there were serious missteps by the White House and the State Department during this period that were a source of really enormous consternation for Mr. Grew. Our time is slipping away rapidly, but could you just tell us one or two of the chief examples of that?
Well, I'll give you the main one that bothered Grew, and that can stand for some of the others. I had no idea until I researched this book that the Prime Minister of Japan, Prince Konoye, in late summer, early fall 1941, just a few months before Pearl Harbor, asked for a secret summit meeting with President Roosevelt in order for Japan to concede whatever it would take to prevent war. And Grew, of course, was very excited by this. No Japanese prime minister had ever traveled outside the country, and especially had never gone to an enemy's country, a potential enemy's country. It was a complete turnaround from the way Prince Konoye had been acting, the way Japan had been acting. He was very excited by this last-minute prospect for peace, and it died in the cradle. Secretary of State Cordell Hull would not set up the meeting until Japan met certain criteria. And Grew said, "No, you can't. We can't do it that way. First, let's have the meeting, and then if they don't stick by what we agree to, then we can put the hammer down on them. We can't ask for criteria first because they're going to say no." And that's what happened. And so Hull effectively strangled this opportunity in the cradle, even though FDR had agreed that he would be glad to meet with Konoye. But he also agreed with Hull that the Japanese needed to take certain steps first, such as withdrawing from Indochina, withdrawing from China. I mean, these are massive things that the Japanese simply were not going to do before meeting with Roosevelt. First of all, it would no longer have been a secret summit because everyone would have known they were withdrawing from these places. So that was very, very frustrating for Gru.
We leave it to our listeners to explore the specifics of this story, which are really the heart and soul of your book. I mean, the day-to-day efforts of Joseph Gru, his tireless efforts to work within a situation that was so incredibly difficult. Ultimately, of course, his efforts, which went right up to really the day of Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor, are, of course, ultimately unsuccessful. He is interned in the Tokyo embassy for 6 months or so before finally reaching home. And I appreciate how your book actually opens with that dramatic ocean voyage back to New York City and to the safety of American soil. But what I want to talk about in our last couple of minutes is this elusive document that Mr. Gru fashioned towards the end of his experience as Japanese diplomat, in which he really assembled a thorough report, which was also, in some respects, in your words, a frank record of his views in terms of what had unfolded. Tell us what ultimately happened, or what we know about this report, which would have shared so much information about this important moment in our history.
Well, Gru wrote this while he was interned in the embassy after Pearl Harbor for 6 months, and he was troubled. What could have happened that it would have changed this? Was there anything that anyone could have done to alter these events? And so he went back over his diary, all his dispatches to and from the State Department, and wrote this final report, which was 275 pages long or something like that, and he intended to give it to Hull and Roosevelt as soon as he got home. And he did. As soon as he got back to America, he saw Secretary Hull, handed him the report, and gave him a summary of it. This did not go over well. Hull basically threw the report back in his face and said, "You will destroy every copy of this, or I will publicize it to the American people." And Gru, he didn't want to publicize it because he didn't want to seem like he was at odds with his government, which was at war with Japan. So he was a deep patriot. He didn't want to undermine the government. At the same time, he didn't want to, turn his back on the historical record, which he thought was important. So evidently he did destroy much of the document, but it remains in his archive in a boulderized fashion, and with about, 130 pages of it cut out. And he put in the margin, "destroyed at Mr. Hull's request," or something like that.
Mm. I think you tell us he refused to clean up the crime scene. In other words, he wanted to leave very clear evidence of why the original version of this full report had been destroyed.
Yes, but and just to be clear, he didn't accuse the government of purposefully avoiding peace. He didn't know if anything would have made any difference. He doubted it, and it's not an answerable question. He didn't think anything could have prevented these martial fanatics in Japan from doing what they did, but he was troubled that we hadn't tried every diplomatic path possible, and that was his job, to try those paths, and he felt like he had been blocked in some cases, not only by the Japanese side, but by the American side, and he just wanted that to be clear. I think it is clear in all of his diary, in all of his dispatches, and so essentially my book is trying to put together what was in Gru's final report. Why did he come to think, is there anything we could have done differently?
Mm. Steve Kemper's marvelous book is titled Our Man in Tokyo. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Dr. Gerald Mast joins us He is, of course, from the political science faculty at Carthage College. And Professor Mast will be joining us to look back at last week's midterm elections. What happened and why it happened and what it says about what might be ahead for our country over the next couple of years.